I found very compelling an editorial today in the National Post. My right to live trumps your right to die. Derek Medina writes, letter writer Anik Jensen thinks her two severely disabled sons would be better off dead. She wrote, bring an end to my children's so-called life. And Medina writes, I give thanks every day that my disabled twin brother is alive. And he takes up through the course of this piece why it is dangerous to legalize assisted suicide and gives examples from other countries where it's been in place for a while. Derek Medina is a researcher at the Institute of Marriage and Family Canada, and he joins me now. Derek Medina, welcome.
Hello, how are you?
I'm doing well.
Good.
We're both alive and well.
Yeah.
And happy to be so. Well, the first question, and I'm sure you're asked this, Derek, if somebody else decides to die, what business is it of yours? It doesn't affect your life.
Well, their decision wouldn't immediately affect mine, but that decision would be part of a cultural shift, which would make death a better treatment than long-term care, for example.
Mm-hmm.
It would make death the option that people would take, and it would make it, again, a cheaper option than other sources of care. So my concern, and I realize this isn't where euthanasia laws would start, but my concern is that eventually the society would shift to making death a choice that someone in my brother's situation, although he can't make it himself, that would be a choice that would be foisted on him because it's very expensive to keep him alive. And as anyone knows who lives with government stipend, government funds, it can be very expensive to keep a person alive. So it's cheaper to kill them off, and that would be at least pressure given to me and my family.
Yeah, and a lot of people will poo-poo that, but you give great examples here in other countries, and we'll get to that in a moment. But let's talk about your brother. He's 39 years old, and you write, due to complications at birth, he's still in diapers and fed via a feeding tube. He gets around in a wheelchair only when pushed by someone else. He can't talk. So I'm sure there are people who say that's no life. He'd be better off gone.
Well, you know, I like to say that, and it's true that my brother has a smile that lights up rooms. And when I can lay on the floor with him and get him to smile, bring him happiness, that's just a happiness that seems to flow through everyone in the room. You obviously have to be have to know him. You have to be willing to see him for who he really is. You have to be willing to see a quality of life. But his life clearly didn't end when he became disabled at birth. That's an odd way to put it.
Yeah.
But it's much more complicated, basically, than he's much more complicated than what you'd see on the surface.
Well, I'm sure. But what I'm saying is, and by the way, I'm in agreement with you on your column. I'm just trying to hit you with questions I think come to the mind of other people.
Yeah, and I appreciate.
Okay, and I'm sure a lot of people could look at sort of the external circumstances there. They don't play with them as you do and see the smile, and they would say, that's no life to live, by which they mean, I wouldn't want to live like that, so therefore he'd be better off dead.
Yeah, well, and I think, you know, I've done some research on people who've experienced spinal cord injury. And that's a similar situation in terms of people saying they wouldn't want to live that way. I think, the reality in my research is that people with spinal cord injury, for example, with time, with family support, with community support, with the ability to play a role in larger society, whatever that is, people can gain a different sense of quality of life, but it's not any less important or any less valuable, the sense of quality of life that they have. So there's no way that anyone who is healthy and well can say, I would feel this way when I'm not, because it's a totally different reality and it takes some time to adjust to that new reality.
Let's talk about these other countries that you profile. Belgium, for instance, I guess they have had euthanasia for some time there?
Mm-hmm. They have. It's been legalized more recently, I believe in the early 2000s.
All right, and the experience that you think is alarming for us?
Well, the experience that's alarming is that about one-third of euthanasia deaths done by doctors happened without the explicit request of the person that was killed. That's a long and short way of saying doctors killed patients when they didn't ask for it. And what's even more difficult and what's even more alarming is that when doctors were asked why they did this, some doctors decided for the patient that this was just the best option without talking to them. And others thought that the conversation about dying would be so hard on the individual that it was better that they killed them instead.
Just don't tell them it's going to happen.
No, just don't tell them it's going to happen. So this is clearly a case of doctors jumping in and making the decision on behalf of patients. So to say that euthanasia and assisted suicide would lead to choice at the end of life, this is clearly a case where it opened the door to doctors taking away that choice.
Yeah, we'll talk about a couple of other countries in a moment, but you've described your brother, and I've read a little of what you wrote in this column about your brother. It doesn't sound like he could make an informed choice on his own behalf.
No, he couldn't. But the reality is that as family members or as caregivers, anyone who has a legal responsibility in terms of caring for him could make that decision on his behalf. It's also the case in countries like the Netherlands and in Belgium that it's not reported quite often. I think a recent study in Belgium, it was well over half, like 58% of all cases of euthanasia weren't reported. If you bring in that reality, then it would be entirely possible down the road for someone to choose that on his behalf and not be reported.
In-depth radio, News Talk 1010. I'm Jerry Yeager. I'm talking to Derek Medima. He's a researcher at Institute of Marriage and Family Canada, has a great piece in the National Post today, My Right to Live Trumps Your Right to Die. So, Derek, we're talking about your brother. He's severely disabled, has been since birth. Could not make an informed decision on his own. Some people who are charged with looking after a severely disabled individual, if we had assisted suicide, could possibly just decide, I'm just going to say that his life isn't worth living because actually mine isn't while I have to look after him.
Mm-hmm. Well, two things. When my brother and I were 18, it became too much of a daily struggle for my mom to bathe him, feed him, care for him, so he went into a group home and has been in there since he was 18, so for 21 years. I know that for my grandfather, my maternal grandfather, my mom and my aunt looked after him, laundry, etc., but it became too much to do that, so he went into a retirement home. I think in these kind of situations, we not only need to advocate and work towards more group homes, more retirement homes, but we also need to look at respite care, home care, more services, more medical services that can be provided in home to give caregivers a break, because that is a huge, huge issue. And I totally understand caregiver burnout. My mom was on the mat, basically, by the time my dad died. It was a horrible, difficult time. But that's not to say that the only option to deal with that is euthanasia and assisted suicide. More support for caregivers is an absolute necessity.
You write in your piece in the Post, reports from the Netherlands indicate 500 people died without their consent in 2005 alone.
Mm-hmm.
That's amazing.
It is amazing. You know, and this is a continuing reality in the Netherlands. That's 500 people who didn't ask to die and were killed, the same as we just spoke about in Belgium. But 500 people in 1 year, that's the last last year that we have stats so that's why it's 2005.
Do you worry that some people could, in fact, if the system were allowed to do so, make a decision based solely on the financial aspect? This person isn't living much of a life anyway, according to us, and costing the system a lot of money, so...
Well, that was in the letter that I responded to. Annika Jansen noted also that her sons were very expensive to take care of and that it would be cheaper. I mean, I'm paraphrasing, of course, but she raised that issue. So I think that that's a very real concern, also because we have an aging society. And for all your listeners out there who realize that we have an aging society or are part of that aging group, we realize it's going to be expensive to take care of people. And so we have this financial pressure. If we throw that into the mix, it becomes a powerful push, perhaps, to legalize assisted suicide and euthanasia. But we also know from studies that palliative care is much more is cheaper to provide than is a hospital bed, even in a palliative care ward, let alone an acute care ward like a cancer ward or something. It's much cheaper to provide quality palliative care. So if we expanded palliative care services, especially in this era of an aging society, we could not cut our expenses, but we could cut our expenses per capita.
Derek, I want you to take this call here from Alex from Cambridge. Alex?
Hi there. I just wondered if you have ever actually spent any time in palliative care with a loved one who is dying from a devastating illness and begging you to please make the pain stop. My mother went from a beautiful, vivacious, energy-filled woman at 52 years old, got bone cancer. In the 4 months that she was in palliative care, she asked numerous times for it to stop, for it to end, for us to please, if we loved her, to make it end. And I don't think you are entirely qualified to say that this is something we should not do unless you've looked into the eyes of someone that you have more love for than you can imagine and tell them there's nothing you can do.
Alex, we're talking about people who aren't capable of making the decision for themselves. Should they just be put down?
My question is, should people who are capable, does his argument fall in that people who are capable of making the decision for themselves should be allowed to do so?
All right. Derek, what's your answer to her question?
Well, first of all, I also mentioned that my own father died of ALS, and I have a 50-50 chance. So I understand the difficulty, and I also have experience as a volunteer in a hospital in a palliative care ward. I wonder in that situation, and palliative care specialists in that situation will say that a person crying for help like that isn't crying for death necessarily. What's lacking in general is pain control and quality palliative care. If it was possible for your mother in this case to die in comfort without any pain and have that quality care, that's what I would wish for you. That's what I would wish for your mother. And the issue is not an individual issue, though. The issue is not whether your mother could have the choice or whether my dad could have the choice. The issue is how individual choice will change society and bring pressure upon the most vulnerable in our society.
Derek Medima, researcher at Institute of Marriage and Family Canada, thanks for taking time this morning.
Thank you very much.
Well, we could tell during that conversation just moments ago here on News Talk 1010 that emotions run high when you start to talk about the right to die, the right to live, living with pain. And I was talking to the author of a column in the National Post today, Derek Medima, My Right to Live Trumps Your Right to Die. He talked about his own personal situation in this column. His father died from ALS. There's a 50% chance that he himself will get ALS. His brother has been disabled, severely disabled, since birth, and he warns that we can get to a situation where we're a different type of society than we meant to be if we legalize suicide. That's his argument, legalize assisted suicide. Alex called in, and she talked about the pain that her mother was in the last months of her life, and her mother was asking for it all to end. Now, whether Derek Medima is right or not, that people are not asking to die, they're asking for the pain to stop, Alex's mother was making a request about her own life. And that's not what Derek Medima was most concerned about in his column. He's concerned about people who can't make an informed decision, or perhaps even communicated decision, so someone else makes it for them. And tragically, we found in countries that have legalized assisted suicide that it is not a more progressive, more enlightened way to go. Defaulting towards a respect for life as opposed to death puts us in a better place as a society, I believe, because we wouldn't have happened what he reports has happened in Belgium, in Switzerland, the Netherlands, where, in fact, they have legalized assisted suicide. Let me remind you of one of the statistics he gave us. Reports from the Netherlands indicate that 500 people died without their consent in 2005 alone. It's not an enormous population in the Netherlands. But 500 people in 1 year because somebody else decided their life wasn't worth living. Why would those decisions be made? They may be made on an informed and caring basis, but they may be made because somebody has just decided, I don't like looking after Uncle Billy anymore, and so I'm going to publicly state that Uncle Billy had told me in the past that if it came to this, he wanted to die. That puts an end to that problem. It could be that when Uncle Billy passes on, nephew George gets an inheritance. It could be that some cold, calculating bureaucrat at an insurance company decides we're not going to pay for this anymore, as was the case in Oregon, where cancer patient Barbara Wagner got a letter from the Oregon Health Plan stating they wouldn't pay for an expensive new drug that doctors felt might help her, but they would pay for assisted suicide. Could that happen when you only have one insurance company and that insurance company is already forcing people to wait months and months for the care they need, as happens already in this country? Yes, it could.